Hello, this is episode 86 of the podcast called Blood and Rain. I'm your host, Arthur Dane. Today marks a very significant part of the Blood and Rain podcast. I've been feeling for some time that I could use a co-host for some of my episodes. And today I am joined by my new co-host, Adam Mercatoris, as he's sort of Latinized his name, very much like the subject matter we'll get into later today. Adam and I met through Instagram. He hails from the Netherlands. He's of both Dutch and French blood. And he pretty recently joined Anti-Fragile Athletes, and any of you listeners should also join as well. And within the Anti-Fragile Athletes chat, a subject that I have grown enamored with for the past 2 years was littering the chat, and a chat that should have been more dedicated to Olympic lifting, Muay Thai technique, bioenergetics, so on and so forth. So we made a separate chat for political theory that we jokingly called Gang Gang Hugo Grotius, because that was quite literally the first name that I could think of. And that chat sort of blew up, and it's quite fitting that we chose Hugo Grotius as a name, because that is the subject of today's podcast. So this will be part one, Jus Publicum Europaeum, or European public law, regarding the French and Dutchman, Hugo de Groot, Latinized into Hugo Grotius. So I'm very excited to get into the subject matter, but I'm very excited to introduce all of you, our new co-host on Blood and Rain, Adam Mercatoris. For all episodes regarding sort of research of political theory within our respective correspondents and our group chat. Welcome, Adam. Thank you so much for being here.
Yes, thank you very much for having me. Looking forward to, you know, spurging about all these very difficult and interesting subjects with you.
Likewise. And, you know, we both have the capacity to spurg, and I'd say the bulk of the people in that chat are sort of spurg happy. You and I both have a... There's a meme that sort of floated around within the AFF sphere. I noticed pretty early on that Adam was someone who liked very long-winded, detailed descriptions. And one time he asked me the simple question of how do you work 12 hours a day? And instead of telling him the same thing that I told another AFF member, which is like, you just do it. I gave him this long description as to my background, and he basically superimposed that on the Tucker Carlson, Vladimir Putin meme. Says, Arthur, how do you work for 12 hours a day? I was born of a Basque father and Basque Italian mother in the San Francisco Bay Area in the 90s. So that made me laugh for a good 5 minutes straight, honestly. So we are discussing your Dutch-French compatriot, Hugo Grotius, which is Latinized of Hugo de Groot. It's a subject matter that you and I are both lamented about the fact that it's quite endless, not just his own life, not just his influences, not just the given circumstances surrounding his life and work, and not just the impact that it has to this day. So we split up sort of various topics regarding Hugo Grotius and Jus Publicum Europaeum, and we figured it best to start with the man himself. And I'll give it to Adam now, because he's done some extensive research in the past couple of weeks regarding to the background of Hugo Grotius and how he came to be the man he is known today.
Yes, thank you very much. So Hugo Grotius in the Netherlands, he's famous, but he's interestingly enough not very famous for the things we're going to be talking about today. He's known as being a statesman and being a bit of a contrarian in his own time. His most famous story is essentially how he was imprisoned in a Dutch castle midway down his life with his family, and his famed escape from that castle was because he essentially hid in his own bookshelf, which was then carried out by the people who essentially sent him books, took in the old ones, because he was a very avid learner, as we will get into. But if you actually get into the history of the man, he's a fascinating figure to look at. He came from a very highly established family of patricians, for the lack of a better word, from the city of Delft, which is right now probably our tech capital of the country. It's where all our engineers and mathematicians, scientists, we usually go to learn the stuff that we are, you know, remarkably good at. We kind of get overshadowed with it from time to time. But his grandfather was mayor of that town for several years. His uncle was a very successful professor, or at least student of the humanities and law. And his father was also a, you know, real estate merchant. It's the apple didn't fall very far from the tree, as we'll soon see. And he was born on Easter Sunday, in the 10th of April, 1583, during the Dutch revolt against Spain, and also in larger extent against the Habsburg Empire, which was our colonizer, for the lack of a better term at the moment, which was known in later terms, in later times, as the 80 Years' War. And he also lived right in the epicenter of where the revolution was orchestrated from the Dutch perspective, because it was the seat of William the Taciturn, or otherwise known as William of Orange, who is the first of the Dutch royal family that's still in power. It's not really power right now, but they're still around. And there was also a massive switch, I guess, because of the wars for religion, where Calvinism was becoming the state religion. Public practice of Roman Catholicism was being completely outlawed because the Reformed strain of Christianity had much more influence in the people in power, with the people in power. So the Pax Christiana was unfurling. The entire worldview was kind of falling apart in the Netherlands, not just for reasons of Catholicism disappearing, but also the Aristotelian way of life, essentially, or at least the view of how the world works. So, massive intellectual and religious crisis were going on, which is probably a very fertile breeding ground for any form of intellectual development, for better or for worse. And this was the context that Hugo Grotius essentially started off in. So in that sense, again, not surprising that he had so much to say about the way the world should function or function at the time. And there was also something I came across, very prophetic quote, was there was a sketch that was made of him during his childhood, and it's translated read as follows. "Still small, but bearing the name great in memory of my forefathers, I occupy myself with small things, but in due time I shall pursue greater things." He was probably six at the time of this quote, so writing was definitely on the wall, but it definitely made me realize, 22 years old and I'm being intellectually mugged by a preteen. So I guess that was just the way the Dutch were at the time. You know, it's just very inspiring in that sense, but also a bit confronting. So he attended Latin school while also simultaneously being homeschooled by his father. So he was essentially just writing Latin poetry for the Dutch government by the time he was eight. He made this ode to Prince Maurits, I believe, who was a relative of William the Taciturn, praising his military exploits and all that sort of stuff. So he was, from the very beginning, he was already hands-on regarding the entire political situation in the Netherlands. And his studies, which started at the age of eight, carried him very far. He was known as an exemplary student at the age of 11, when he was already studying law at a very high level, and very much surrounded by influential thinkers, professors. So the entire intelligentsia of the time knew about him. So he was also being groomed and reared into the position he would find himself in from day one, essentially. And after his studies, which took 4 years, so he was 15 at the time, in 1598, he accompanied Johan van Oldenbarneveldt, who is probably one of the most influential men in Dutch history, period. He is the one who founded the East India Trading Company. He was one of the other architects of the Dutch revolt against the Spanish, and just a very learned, well-educated man who got very involved in the Reformation in the Netherlands at the time. He took him on a diplomatic mission to Paris, getting support from the French against Spain. And at the court of King Henry IV of France, he was already hailed as the miracle of Holland when he was 15 years old. So again, a remarkable child, even, or maybe even a man, if we can think in their terms. So he got his degree in Roman and canon law in the city of Orleans. I'm probably butchering that pronunciation, but he got it at the age of 15, was a successful philologist by the age of 17, and wrote history sponsored by the Dutch state by the time he was 18, all of which he achieved international recognition for by essentially every great thinker of the time. So that was just his first 18 years of life. So if you feel like you haven't accomplished much in your first 18 years, yeah, by your standards, you're probably right, unfortunately.
you are correct. It's over. Stop trying. Goodbye.
Very much so. So yeah, that's basically his early life, as condensed as I can make it. I'm probably skipping out on many details and achievements, but this is essentially just to illustrate how much of a prodigy he was. I argue he was probably the Mozart of European law, if I had to make a comparison.
I think that's pretty apt. I remember seeing in passing, and when I was reading one of his books in the introduction, he passed the bar at 17. It's just absurd to think about. Sorry, do carry on.
Well, I'm actually done regarding his early life, because his studies, well, I mean, his studies ended here, and he essentially just started for the real thing directly after this. So I'm pretty sure his work regarding Mare Liberum and Europia, Jus Europaeum, they are essentially the next in line. So we can probably just get into its Spanish influences, if you don't mind.
Certainly. I should have mentioned earlier in introducing you that Adam has long-term ambitions in academia. So his capacity for collecting and processing information is pretty sublime. On the landscape of the world at the time, this was the age of exploration, about close to 100 years in. So obviously, if we're talking in terms of what was explored within the New World, the earliest understanding we have of this is Leif Erikson, Eric the Red, crossing over on the northern Atlantic to parts of what would now be northern Quebec. The next explorers to reach the New World, and this is some information I'll get further into in a podcast I'll do solo in the future about the Basques, were indeed the Basques. So the next intro you had in terms of reaching across the Atlantic were from the Basques. And for those of you who aren't familiar, they're pre-Indo-European Europeans that are on the corner of the Bay of Biscay, bordering on the border of both Spain and France. They had a long maritime tradition for whaling, and they actually achieved contact with the Vikings, and from them they learned how to build sturdier hulls for transatlantic journeys, and they also learned how to cure fish. So the next explorers of the New World are the Basques, and then of course Columbus in 1492. He still believed that he had reached India, when in fact he reached was essentially the Caribbean. And after some time, it was realized that they had reached the New World, a world that was previously unknown to at least the majority of European nations. When the Spanish, English, and French in particular started to arrive, they were greeted with some relics of Norse visitation, and with natives speaking Basque. So that was a big mystery that they had when they reached the New World. Spain was first to really seize the moment, especially not just doing ports of Columbus, but Cortez, Pizarro, setting up viceroyalties in what is present-day Mexico and Peru, respectively. For those, as an aside, for those of you who are in the sort of Graham Hancock rabbit hole, and I know Andrew's probably listening now, our good friend the Saxon Cross, who's further down the Graham Hancock rabbit hole than I've ever been, one of his more mainstream sort of talking points was that there is a series of cities in the Amazon that were written about by a particular explorer, and when they were revisited decades later, all those cities were gone. However, in present day, we're beginning to dig up in the Amazon due to soybean farmers there. What is the evidence of these cities, essentially, that were overgrown after what was likely smallpox wiped them all out? So we're dealing with a new world that, in the Catholic worldview, this is before the Battle of the English Channel. So really, the hegemon of the world at this time, the first overseas empire, is Spain. Spain is a powerful maritime Catholic empire that grew to be so martially capable due to 800 years of the Reconquista from the Umayyad and Abbasid caliphates, basically holding the bulk of what was Spain, as they called Al-Andalus. As part of the Basque pride, the Reconquista of Spain began with the Basques in the north, and over the course of 800 years, they were successful in removing Islam. They were successful in removing any kind of foreign conquest of the Iberian Peninsula. So Spain, through 800 years of struggle and bloodshed, became this powerhouse of a nation. They turned their attention overseas post-Columbus and Ferdinand and Isabella. They sailed as far as the west coast 100 years later, circumvented the globe. Another caveat, Magellan had died somewhere near the Philippines, close to Cebu. And who took over was a Spanish Basque captain. So the struggle, really, the challenger to Spanish conquest of the Atlantic and in the New World was Portugal. And there's the famous asking the Pope to draw a line on a map, basically closing his eyes. And what is the New World is essentially gifted to Spain, and what is Africa and basically what is Indonesia today, the Dutch East Indies, that entire hemisphere, the Western Eastern Hemispheres. The East belonged to Portugal, the West belonged to Spain. Now, there were, as people in the Spanish aristocracy began to catch wind, that people like Hernán Cortés and Pizarro were basically extinguishing Native American populations, whether Incan or Aztec, or Olmec or what have you, in present-day Latin America. From a moral standpoint, there were many sort of Catholic theologian philosopher straddling types. It's worth noting that the sort of Catholic world of philosophy is descended from a straddling the border of theology and humanism that was established by St. Augustine. St. Augustine is a more controversial saint in the context of the Orthodox world, with the exception of the just war principle. But in terms of the West, and as the West was separated due to being cut off from the East by the swooping of the pagan Slavs through the Balkan Peninsula, suddenly you had a Mediterranean region that no longer spoke predominantly Greek and Latin, but you had the East speaking only Greek and the West only speaking Latin. And St. Augustine, being a master of the Latin language, was a large influence on the Catholic world. This was doubled down by Alcuin of York, who was the teacher of Charlemagne, who was predominantly Augustinian in his theology. And Charlemagne wanted to essentially be crowned by God. and he was crowned by the Pope, the Patriarch of the West. And that sort of set the stage for, in some ways, controversial, if you were to look at it a purist Orthodox standpoint, in some ways quite beautiful flourishing of Western thought. This was further increased with the Renaissance, when much of Byzantium thought that was written and cataloged was brought to Italy in the Renaissance at the fall of the Byzantine Empire. So this sort of school of humanism sort of binded and philosophy binded with theology, we have these two characters introduced in the world stage in terms of the morality of this conquest of the new world. They're both of the name Francisco Vitoria and Francisco Suarez of Salamanca, who Suarez in particular was most likely the greatest influence of Hugo Grotius. Francisco Suarez argued that it couldn't be denied that the people across the water in the Atlantic, they were their own nations. So for there to be a conquest just for conquest's sake is not in line with the true morality of Catholicism. And therefore, God would not be on the side of the Spanish Empire, would frown upon the Spanish for conquest without just cause. So of course, this just cause became conversion. Now, this was sort of murky in the early days of the Spanish settlers. But as time went on, and as Spain became increasingly fiercely Catholic, it was clear that the only way that God would smile upon Spain in this overseas conquest would for it to be a conquest of conversion. And so you saw the beginning of missionaries being sent all over South America, from southern Patagonia all the way up north to California, the famous trek of Junipero Serra. And this had a great influence on the mind of Hugo Grotius. When we see the world in the context of Grotius's life, it's the late 1500s, the 1580s. We're beginning to see the changing of hands of the Protestants, of the Catholic dominance of Europe to the rise of Protestantism. Henry VIII creating the Anglican Church, and Calvinism running rampant in Central Europe, as Adam mentioned before, with the Dutch Revolution, the Dutch Revolt, from the Habsburgs and from the Spanish. As a side note, I actually find it interesting. I remember once upon a time I listened to the Wilhelmus, the Dutch national anthem in the European Championship in 2008. I was like, oh, that's quite a nice sounding national anthem. And I looked at the lyrics and I saw that it still had the King of Spain in it. I'm like, oh, that's quite odd. All right, that's interesting. So I that was the first point that I knew that there was a Spanish overlord in the Netherlands. But in the context of the rise of Calvinism, we're going to have a stage set where, thanks to the efforts of Sir Walter Raleigh, we saw the end of the true hegemony of Spain. The Spanish Armada was the greatest armada that had been assembled, arguably since the conquest of Troy. Some Asian historians will probably cite some Chinese fleet that was absolutely massive that is discussed in the History Channel once upon a time. I'm not too well versed with Chinese history, so forgive me if I'm not being entirely accurate with that assessment. But for this epoch, it was the most impressive navy ever assembled. The smaller, more maneuverable ships and the tactics of Sir Walter Raleigh allowed the Spanish formation to be broken, England to not be invaded by Spain, and you saw the dawn of what would be a Protestant empire under the influence of Queen Elizabeth and John Dee. So you have that sort of fracturing of the Spanish Catholic hegemony. Funnily enough, though, these Spanish writers, Francisco Vitoria and Francisco Suarez, were sort of the basis of some of Hugo Grotius's thought in terms of international law. Funnily enough, it didn't really have anything to do with other European powers, but a European power in a formerly Native American empire, particularly in the case of the Aztecs. Present-day Mexico City, Tenochtitlan, so on and so forth. Why this is important, it's almost the philosophical opening from a very closed-off Catholic consensus for there not to be a route of bloodshed in terms of the relation between nations, as long as it's predicated on something that is almost a higher call. In the case of the Spanish, that it was conversion. In the case of the post-30 Years' War, which we'll get to later on, I don't want to get too ahead of ourselves, it's quite literally just the cause of peace. More than 50% of the German people were wiped out in the 30 Years' War before the Peace of Westphalia. And the thoughts that were emerging in the mind of Hugo Grotius started with these Spanish philosophers of international law. And he actually began to argue religious freedom, which is actually, and through that association of the aforementioned figure, was the reason he was in prison in the first place. It was actually his wife, his ride or die of a wife, was the reason he was able to escape prison. She sort of orchestrated him being carried out in that chest of books that was brought to him in prison. She was actually in prison with him as well, that was granted to him. And when she was carrying this chest of books out, the guards noted that you could fit an Armenian in there. She says, well, she joked with him saying that Armenian books are typically very dense and very heavy, and they laughed it off, and he was able to escape to France. I think that's a good sort of place to head it back to you, Adam, in terms of sort of discussing his first sort of claim to fame in resistance to the Portuguese claim on the closed seas. I should note as well, before we get into that, that it is likely one of the reasons why Hugo Grotius sort of cited Spanish philosophers, Spanish theologians that were a bit more egalitarian for the time, was particularly the common enemy of the Dutch that was the Portuguese. The Dutch were a bit later in the game of the Age of Exploration, much like the French and the English were compared to the Spanish and the Portuguese. And that was the basis for his first great book, and later on had influence on his magnum opus. So I'll hand that off to you, Adam.
Yeah, so the book in question is called Mare Liberum, which is essentially the freedom of the seas when you translate it. And this booklet, because it's only 66 pages long, interestingly enough, it's quite short, works out, or at least attempts to work out, how natural law as is established in the philosophical traditions of the time would apply to being able to navigate and use the seas and the and essentially the public waters. And this was especially when it came to freedom of trade and also the conflict that could arise from that. It was also just generally used, or at least he was trying to use it during the truce negotiations that were being held between Spain and between the Netherlands and Portugal. Apparently was a bit too late for that, unfortunately, but the work still stands very much on its own. But the main cause of him writing it was in 1608. There was Yeah, we can just cut this part out. I think I lost my quote. All right, yeah, I think I have it. So it was in 1603 that there was a conflict that rose up in the Strait of Malacca between the Portuguese and the Dutch, because what essentially happened was there was a seizure by a Dutch admiral around the Straits of Singapore then, of a Portuguese carrack, which was carrying a lot of wealth. But the reason he claimed it was essentially because the Portuguese had been mistreating Dutch merchants in Portuguese Asia. So they saw the attack as retaliatory. The Portuguese obviously viewed it a bit different than that. And this was essentially the match that lit the entire discussion about, okay, who was actually in the right here. And Hugo Grotius, who was actually hired by the Chamber of the East India Company, because for a bit of context, the East India Company was probably the biggest power point that we had in the Netherlands at the time. And it was collectively owned essentially by many different investors and ran by four houses or chambers, which had a central board of 17 men that were dispersed throughout the Netherlands at the time. And they asked Hugo Grotius, after the seizure of the carrack and all the problems that came with it, can you essentially give a explanation, or at least a rebuttal against the Portuguese for why we were justified in seizing this? And it's very much a legal argument that is obviously rooted in natural law, but what it essentially sets out is that the Dutch have a right to navigate and trade in the Portuguese East domains, and the Portuguese shouldn't have any right to exclude the Dutch, because natural law would stipulate that everyone should have free access to the world seas and oceans, which is called jus navigandi, because the seas cannot be appropriated from that point of view. It's not open to occupation, or occupatio, as it was called, because it's considered a common good to all mankind, essentially. Because all things that are essentially nature, as he would put it, so the air, the sea, the shore, it's all common ground, essentially. So from that flowed, essentially, that navigation and fishing rights should also be universal to everyone. And the sea is not an object of trade by itself, or subject to the servitude. It's simply the space in which all those trades take place. So he essentially attacks the Portuguese claim to dominion in East Asia, and then extrapolates on the right to free navigation, as well as the right on free trade, and basically points out that the reason that seizing Portuguese goods by the Dutch was righteous is simply because the East Indies should be accessible to all. Religion is also not a ground for denying rights on property or trade, because the Netherlands at this time was already being very heavily influenced by Calvinism, while the Portuguese were still very much a Catholic nation, as they still are today. But it shouldn't be a ground for excluding trade on religious difference. The sea and navigation also couldn't be a certain country's exclusive right purely because they discovered it, because that's not a justifiable way to acquire property in Hugo Grotius' view. And he also was very skeptical of monopolistic rights by a nation on any sort of trading. So this would go beyond just maritime trade, but trade in general. So he had a very broad and very detailed argument for the seizure of this carrack, but it left its mark on a lot of the laws surrounding the seas that we have today. But interestingly enough, it was also a very criticized document at the time of publication. There was this professor of law at the University of St. Andrews called William Wellwood, who essentially heavily criticized Hugo Grotius' claim, by essentially attacking the point that there is no form of territory at all in the sea. Whereas William Wellwood, amongst a few others, stated that territorial waters should apply at least in some sense, because fishing is the main point that he brought up, where in the intrusion of foreign fishing companies not just stole their wealth, but also their very way of sustenance, because fishing, especially in Portugal, was also just a very big source of food for its citizens. And this criticism and discussion is essentially where the entire concept of territorial waters as it is understood today originates. There might have been some writings on it beforehand, but this is essentially the watershed moment in that discussion, where it was elevated in terms of how people discussed it. And when people discuss it now, it does usually come back to this divergence in a discussion. And Hugo Grotius did actually contradict or at least take a contrary opinion to to William Wellwood's statement, saying that nobody is capable of appropriating the sea in any form. There are no demarcation lines in the seas. He stated that perhaps the flood mark was the actual border between a country's state dominion and the sea itself. So he was, you know, very, very meticulous in how he defined these terms. Let's see.
Also worth it's worth noting as well that religion's part to play in this dispute between the Portuguese and the Dutch can't be overstated. The reason being the aforementioned sort of line drawn by the Pope. So the Pope basically saying everything in the Western Hemisphere outside of the boundaries of Europe, essentially, is the dominion of Spain. And everything in the Eastern Hemisphere outside of the bounds of Europe is the dominion of Portugal. And this included Africa and Asia. And now you have this sort of rupturing of the Western Church with the Protestant Reformation taking its most potent form in Calvinism. Giving this sort of decentralized form of Christianity that gave this sort of decentralized, right? So there's a mirror there. The centralized understanding of the world's oceans, like the centralized religion of Catholicism, and the decentralized nature of Calvinism, and the decentralized view of the seas. It's pretty fitting that Grotius would sort of respond to his criticisms with the sort of boundaries of the flood mark in terms of, which would probably give down the line, I'm speculating here, I don't have any research to back this, but this probably laid the groundwork for what could be considered today international waters. There's a caveat to this, though. If the papal claim was actually able to be backed up by force, that it really wouldn't matter what argument that Grotius would be able to make, regarding this dispute in Asia. If there was a scenario where there's a papal navy that sort of worked in unison with the Spanish and Portuguese navies after that claim, it would just take force, quite frankly, in order to actually rupture that consensus. Another example for the American listeners who haven't heard the word freedom in 40 minutes. The Monroe Doctrine, drafted by John Quincy Adams during the presidency of James Monroe, the fifth United States president, basically outlawed further European expansion into the New World. That's all well and good in declaration, and this was, you know, a bid for the United States to really have control over their sphere, which is both North and South America. The British Navy was the one to actually really uphold the Monroe Doctrine up until the early 20th century. the British were the ones preventing the New World being further occupied by Spain or by France or by the Netherlands, for that matter, or by Portugal. And there was funding of Simón Bolívar's revolution in South America. So you're starting to have these independent states, not just the United States, but it was present-day Brazil. I think it was the Republic of La Plata, which is basically Argentina, Paraguay, I think parts of Chile and Uruguay. So you have these states that are more malleable in terms of trade, in terms of the United Kingdom, the British Empire, setting up this empire of commerce in the New World, not having to deal with direct threat of empires for dominion of parts of Canada, the Caribbean. And given the fact that the United States and the British Empire share, at this point at least, shared a common blood, the common Anglo blood, this is a lot more favorable to them. So basically, to sum up, the only case where you can make this claim over waters is if you have naval hegemony. Today, that hegemony quietly belongs to the United States with the Bretton Woods Agreement, but that's not quite, it's not quite the same as it was back then, which I think we'll get into in the second part of this podcast. Do carry on, Adam. Apologies.
Yeah, no problem. Well, interestingly enough, now you do mention kind of the contemporary developments regarding territorial waters and international law, is that especially after the Second World War, the entire discussion about the law of the sea has basically been restarted, because now we have a lot of new regulations regarding, you know, exploitation of the sea, so oil drilling, minerals, natural resources, deep seabed mining, also just like conservationism, so areas of the sea that just shouldn't be exploited by anyone due to its inherent value, just as, you know, coral reefs, for example. So right now we have essentially just a massive clusterfuck almost of just having no idea anymore what belongs to who, because now we have economic zones that are established, you know, 200 miles out from the country's maritime borders. So there's, again, a lot of recontextualization, because, you know, the entire world stage essentially changed remarkably after World War II, obviously. So they say that freedom of the sea is still the leading idea in this whole situation. But again, a lot of discussion is taking place again over it. But Hugo Grotius did have a massive impact on the entire vision of what international law should be regarding the oceans. And contemporary professors right now also state that if Hugo Grotius had not written anything else except Mare Liberum, his place in the development of laws in the entire history of the world would probably already have been very much established on those 66 pages of text alone. But he did not stop there at all, because he is much more known in the international law world of research for the book De Jure Belli Ac Pacis, or The Laws of War and Peace. So I'm not sure if you would like to preface this with anything, Arthur.
I would say this, I'll just say very briefly, this text is responsible for the ideas behind the Peace of Westphalia after the 30 Years' War that permeated through Europe for 300 years. So the consensus, this really marks, I would say, the beginning of at least a Western Europe that is shared in a struggle, not shared friendly, in friendly manner, but shared in a struggle between Protestantism and Catholicism. So you have a group of nations that professes some kind of Western Christian faith that are all somewhat involved in the age of exploration in some capacity, or in the cases of more Central Europe, involved with the ongoing struggles of what are essentially race wars, for lack of a better term. And this sort of laid the groundwork for a little less conquest and a little more treaties, a little more agreements. It's also, some might say that this marks the true beginning of mercantilism, where in terms of hierarchical values, faith and martial capacity weren't really top anymore. There was almost a dilution of the martial capacity with the mercantile capacity, with faith still being present at the highest part of the hierarchy, depending on the nation, whether Calvinist, Anglican, or Catholic. And this stood for 300 years, until Nuremberg in 1945, or the aftermath of World War II in Potsdam, like some of the agreements made at Yalta, and what was solidified in Nuremberg that really solidified as a whole in the 1960s. So this text marks the beginning of the mercantile, more nuanced political religious struggle of Western Europe, and how the winners of that struggle in, you know, each respective decade affected not only the European continent, but later on Africa, the United States, South America, Asia, so on and so forth. I just say that as a preface, because the text itself can't really be understated in importance. So please do carry on.
Yeah, so like I've already pointed out, the context was essentially that, you know, the religious wars are having such a massive toll on Europe that Hugo Grotius was just desperate to find some way to reverse this, you know, incredibly destructive downward spiral that Western Europe was going down at the moment. So how many of the researchers say he wanted peace, so he wrote a book about war? That's basically what the entire text is about. And interestingly enough, it's technically three books. It's a bundle of many different cases and arguments and just research that he shares with us. So the start of the book is essentially a Stoic idea, interestingly enough, that states that man is a social animal and naturally inclined to form societies on all levels. So from the most basic familial unit to the macro structure of Western Europe, essentially. And from natural law, he also adds to that within those societal structures, there's also mutual obligations between the people of those structures. And it can be enforced by lawsuits or, if necessary, actual warfare. But such means of enforcement were not available to natural law in the wider sense, because it was supposed to serve, you know, justice at the highest possible level, instead of just the very simple eye for an eye doctrine, essentially. And there were many matters of moral law that would complicate this situation, because, you know, warfare can get very messy in terms of moral lines and where they end and where they stop. And he also tries to delineate between those two by saying that there's, you know, divine law and natural law. So there's, you know, a bit of wiggle room regarding natural law in that sense. But book one essentially extrapolates on those, on that statement he makes by answering all those nuances regarding the laws of the Old and the New Testaments, because, you know, Protestantism derives most of its doctrine, you know, not as much from churchly traditions as the Catholics and the Orthodox do, but the Bible is definitely, you know, the main, and in some cases basically the only law that they will use for anything, really. So based on the arguments he makes, he says that the question of whether war could ever be just is yes. I mean, there's many wars in the Old and the New Testament that are justified for many different reasons. So his problem is definitely not with war itself, but more so the different forms it can take. And the just wars that he does lay out, so the reasons a state could have a legitimate right to go to war, are essentially self-defense as the first, the restoration of property rights being the second, the satisfaction of claims, so essentially saying that if a country has laid claim to territory, they're allowed to use warfare to actually enforce that claim if it is disputed by a different party. And the last one is the punishment of severe violations of natural law. So punitive warfare is fair game in the eyes of Grotius. However, because of his Spanish neo-scholastic influence, there needs to be, you know, a very good reason to want to carry out punitive warfare if you want to escalate it that far. Because sometimes, you know, negotiations should be fair game. But if it's really the only road that can be traveled down, then punitive warfare is legitimized in Grotius's eyes. Anything you want to add to this, Arthur?
Not at present. I would keep carrying on with it because this sort of lays the groundwork just fine. I will say this is the first step of there being punishment for waging war, that there be an idea that if one nation were to wage war on the other, that there would be ramifications other than the potential for loss, that there be essentially some finger wagging. I think this will really come to a headway in the Napoleonic Wars and Waterloo in the Congress of Vienna. I think that's the first time where we really see this come into play. But do carry on.
Yeah. So the third book, we've now passed the question of is war legitimate in the first place? Then the just causes for war, and then the third book essentially discusses what the modality of war should be. What are the rules and the limitations that must be applied by everyone when the war is already taking place? So Grotius, for example, was very much in favor of mitigating, the right to kill, plunder, and enslave by the different parties, by also applying the principle of proportionality. So only acts of war that sought restoration of rights without excessive damage were actually lawful. So he definitely tempered much of the status quo that could have been very prevalent in any of the empires and states that preceded the states of his own time. And he bases very much on the idea of Christian ethics, which was formulated as temperamenta, where everyone was essentially obligated to observe moderation and also just forbid certain acts permitted by the laws of war that were established before you, Grotius. And the book essentially ends as well with a plea for both good faith and peace, because those two ideals must also always be in the forefront when any war is declared fought and also avoided, which was too late, unfortunately, for Grotius's own time. But he also wrote this with the idea that perhaps future wars could be prevented after this one had met its end. So he could be seen as a realist if we're viewing this from a international relations perspective, because he definitely acknowledges that the reality of war is just that it's somewhat inevitable, and there are definitely cases where it's the only option you can take, while also having a very strong, somewhat idealistic code of morals that should be held by everyone on all levels of warfare. And an interesting side note as well is that if you go back to Mare Liberum, for example, it also shows how Grotius' own view has kind of evolved throughout the years, because in a part of the war, the book on the laws of war and peace, he essentially revises the statement that was made about territorial waters, where inland seas and rivers and estuaries and borders that can essentially be seen as existing within the actual country itself, actually being considered territorial waters. So he was also updating his own views as the wars progressed and as the criticism to his original works came in. So he was definitely a man who was open to having his mind changed.
Yeah, I think that's what kind of grants a man making such claims legitimacy. If you're going to sort of staunchly sort of declare something and not defend your point from a legitimate refutation, either with refuting that reputation, like giving a counter, or adjusting your worldview to new information, it's not really going to stand the test of time. Kind of a making a point within, because this isn't necessarily a theological point. This isn't a dogmatic point that he's making. So this isn't something that's necessarily going to, you know, be staunchly. It's not necessarily something that's going to remain no matter what throughout the course of time. Of course, this definitely wasn't the case with the post-World War II consensus. But in the case of these two great texts of his, he makes the argument that both Francisco Vitoria and Francisco Suarez made, which is about liberty, which is why those two are especially egalitarian for Catholic circles. Is liberty is a very Protestant concept, at least in terms of historically who would make that application of the word liberty, this kind of straddling of the ego and the straddling of governance with the appeal to faith, that there is something inherently inherently given by God that is liberty. That's certainly the case of the founding United States, the appeal to heaven flag, for those of you who are familiar with your colonial history. So he turned to nature, nature itself being another way that we can sort of, another route we can take towards achieving peace as a goal in itself. The easiest way for any kind of European to make a claim that is allegedly outside of Christianity, and I say allegedly, as many of you know where I stand, the easiest, like the strongest case you can make has to do with Greco-Roman philosophy. Rome being sort of the cradle of European civilization before it was introduced to Christianity, and was the Edict of Milan after the Battle of Milvian Bridge. And so Aristotelian view was, I would say at this point, somewhat crippled in the sense that we're taking a more Platonic route to peace. But paradoxically, it's also Aristotelian in the sense that Aristotelian was the one that was arguing that, no, we actually do have dominion over animals. We do have dominion over nature, you know, in a much more eloquent way, saying we're the sort of apex predator that is capable of reason. So this is the first step in secularization, whether they realize it or not. Among some of the books that Grotius really held on to in his time as he left the Netherlands for France in his exile after he escaped prison was a catechism book for his children. So this is still a man of faith, but this is also a man of the mind. This is a both a theologian and a humanist, which many would say, at least in the Orthodox world, is antithetical. And in some ways I agree, and in some ways I disagree. But that's more of a personal note. But this is the beginning of secularization, whether Suarez, Vitoria, Grotius, I guess down the line you could say Locke, realized it or not. And in the second episode, the second part of this podcast, we're going to get into the secularization of Europe, how this kind of started that clock. The next 200 years, we'll get into the Peace of Westphalia itself. We'll get into the 200 years in between the Peace of Westphalia and the Congress of Vienna. So about less than 200 years, so I'd say 170 years. So the Congress of Vienna, the end of French monarchy kind of being the writing on the wall for the state of monarchy with the Franco-Prussian War. You know, it's another victory for the Protestants, the rise of the German Empire thanks to Otto von Bismarck, the last French monarch stepping down, Napoleon III, the scramble for Africa, the Russo-Japanese War, the Meiji Restoration, the Boer War, World War I and the Treaty of Versailles, and how that set the stage for World War II, resulting in Nuremberg and the United Nations and the current consensus, which is really a mutation of the Jus Publicum Europaeum. All of those things that I mentioned before will be linked to Grotius accordingly. Because whether he realized it or not, this is sort of the future that he ushered in. And those 200 years leading up to, I guess you could say leading up to the American Revolution, the French Revolution, and Waterloo, and the Congress of Vienna, that kind of ushered in a peace for about 40 years in Europe. There was the Franco-Prussian War. There's the Austro-Prussian War. There's the Franco-Austrian War. You had the Crimean War and the Russo-Turkish War. And in the European continent, that's pretty much it. So in some ways, if you viewed it from that lens, you could, if in that time, you could view that Grotius was almost successful with peace as a goal in itself. And one has to question whether peace in itself is really a goal that we should have, as odd as that may seem. Is war ever really just? We can bring Augustine into this. We can bring in the just war principle, but there are very few wars I think that would actually apply to. But paradoxically, peace in itself can breed the decay of humankind. And we've witnessed that in the past about 80 years. The Boer War is the first mechanized war, really. And that was the writing on the wall for World War I. Many of you heard me discuss this before. The Meiji Restoration is important because you had the rise of Japan. Japan being, you know, the first industrialized nation that was not European. So not, you know, American in this, you know, pan-European context, or, you know, natively European in Europe. And how that was sort of the first step in Jus Publicum Europaeum being extended outside of Europe, not in a colonial context, but in literally dealing with other nations. They were instrumental for the Triple Entente in World War I. Versailles basically inadvertently set the stage for the panic for Europe with the United States and the in the Soviet Union. Having this writing on the wall for to basically dictate the soul of Europe. So there are many things that can be attributed to Grotius, and there are many other factors that can contribute to his texts, Jus Publicum Europaeum and the Peace of Westphalia, and how we live today. That's what we'll get into in the second episode, but we couldn't have done it without this extensive amount of information that Adam has laid out for us. So thank you so much, Adam. This is an excellent first episode. It's been a pleasure and an honor.
Thank you very much. The honor and pleasure was likewise.
Glad to hear it. I hate to leave suddenly. I'm about 14 minutes late now to lead the St. Christopher Crucible's weekly men's group. As always, listeners, good night, good storms, God bless. Thank you.